Grateful for this, your day. We can gather together as brethren to worship you and to hear from you in your word. Be with us in this next half hour as we consider things. May it be profitable unto us. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. You know, I was just telling Joanne I'm going to talk about politics, and she said, okay, I can leave.
Radical policies and ways that
For example, newly elected congressional leaders want to tax top earners 70% and categorize as racist virtually anything that is associated with the White House. But also with any kind of established wealth, whether it's great wealth or not so great wealth, if it's established, it's seen as negative. Congress and presidential candidates turn a blind eye to illegal immigration and its attendant public costs while advocating Medicare for all.
Others are calling not only for increased tax on income, but on the taxing the wealth of the wealthy.
And that may sound okay if the number is 50 billion, but how long is it going to take before that percentage increases or the level of the wealth eligible decreases once the camel's nose is under the tent? Not very long. So those are things that are being spoken about. And all of these candidates want to take vast economic and governmental steps to replace what works in terms of energy with sketchy broad-scale solar and wind-powered initiatives, even though the science behind CO2 directly linking to climate change is highly speculative, and the needed scale of engineering to make most of our energy green-based is non-existent. California's new governor and New York City's mayor are introducing universal single-payer health care to their sanctuary state and city, courtesy of taxpayers. Cost and logistics, they'll worry about that later. So these are just some of the things that are going on. The Dictionary of the History of Ideas defines socialism as the belief that all producers ought to share equally in the fruits of combined labor. And Margaret Thatcher, you may remember, captured both socialism's utopianism and deleterious effects with her now famous quip, "Socialism is a good idea until you run out of other people's money." However, on a deeper level, the dictionary continues, socialism is more than an economic formula. It is an expression of faith. Faith in the capacity of the mass of mankind to overcome what is thought of as an alienation or estrangement from its own essential nature, which socialists contend is far more creative, pacific, and altruistic than actual experience might suggest. So, in other words, socialism at bottom is a religion in competition with Christianity. It believes that humanity has within itself the ability and power to repair itself without God. And it replaces God with that believed in, though obviously unverified, ability. It is high humanism. And as such, it denies original sin. For socialism, humanity's sin, as seen in the world, is a result of bad policies and having the wrong people in power only. If only the right people were in power, good policies could be initiated and we'd be on our way toward perfection without God. Utopia, which means literally means no place, could then be achieved. Socialist policies, however, seem always to have the opposite of intended effects, just because they deny this basic tenet of human nature. Consider the Clinton administration's Justice Department, which insisted that mortgage banks and companies lend to no credit history applicants, jettisoning decades of analytic precedent for determining who could pay back a mortgage loan. The banks, under threat, complied, but only after finding an out. And that out was offloading the high-risk mortgages to Wall Street for them to be sliced and diced into securities, which were then sold to unsuspecting or, let's say, otherwise socialistically inspired investors. In other words, state pensions. This occasioned the severest economic downturn since the Great Depression, taking not only the U.S. but the world to the proverbial woodshed financially. So instead of educating people on how to improve their credit rating to qualify for a mortgage, that's not politically expedient enough, the government insisted at the time that banks ignore credit ratings for a happier outcome. Oops. Socialism understands free market capitalism as an entrenched evil that favors people in power. And it is true that free market capitalism can be and is abused. However, its adherents do not view it as a religion, but as a system of economic welfare that rewards work and punishes indolence. Like all systems in a fallen world, it is corruptible, which requires the application of law to correct it where corruption exists. But because it is corruptible doesn't mean it's entirely corrupted as a system. A key difference between capitalism and socialism is, whereas free market capitalism in a free society is, for the most part, mostly open or vulnerable to lawful correction as exposed to because it sees itself as exposed to a higher authority, socialism, on the other hand, understands the system itself as being totally morally right or totally morally wrong. And the system for them that's right is socialism, even though very big mistakes may be made by its adherents in trying to implement it. Stalin and Mao presided over the slaughter of millions of their own people in pursuit of a socialist ideal. And we often forget that Hitler's Nazi party was the National Socialist Party, a fascist version of nationalist wealth transfer. So with socialism, the ends always justify the means, even though there's no proof that the ends are achievable. And thus socialism sees not law, but gerrymandered government policies and their resultant social engineering as the means for achieving its utopian vision, even if it's at the cost of people's liberty, property, or even their lives. And if you listen to some of the policies that the candidates are pro-offering, as they take they're on their road shows, you really see that the tentacles are moving into private property and to pull that out and to level it as much as possible. The notion of a worldwide liberal democracy, largely modeled on the post-war U.S., is to provide a government that enables its citizens to pursue freedom, economic, religious, cultural, which includes speech, And this is ultimately is a bane to socialism, since this view is resistant to the social engineering seen as necessary for socialism to achieve its utopia. There will always be people who want to be responsible for their own economic welfare instead of relying on the state to provide it. People who will believe in God, or that what God says is more important than what the state says, and people whose attendant beliefs will find expression publicly as well as privately. Socialism, for it to be successful, must corral all of this. At first through economic intimidation, and later with more severe means to continue on a societal-wide trek toward utopia. Socialism's goal is to own the means of production. In that way, it can comprehensively apply via the power it declaims its social engineering philosophy. But in the meantime, it will settle for wealth transfer from producers to non-producers or minimal ones.
This is one reason why socialism doesn't have much regard for the family. It's its own really separate from the social utopia of intergenerational sustaining in an age. Socialism views inheritance as property of the state and justifies this as the whole being more important than parts of the whole. The stakes are high just now, and socialism knows it. As the baby boomer generation passes, socialism wants to be on hand to regulate as much familial communities as possible, likely the largest in history, and it must win elections and change laws to do so.
The basic definition of socialism, again, the belief that all producers ought to share equally in the fruit of combined labor, as though all of society was somehow a family or a church, which doesn't even happen in the form of contingent church. And this stands really against the essentially British and later American view of human rights, which, insofar as resources are used equally, rather
insofar as resources are already used Commonwealth also engenders equal protection under the law, and socialism isn't satisfied with this. It wants the authority of everything, regardless of the and so,
jurisprudence, so that people are guilty until proven innocent. And this, by the way, is also seen in some of the policies we have time to give you an example later, presented by candidates, all the while claiming to take the rule of law as the holy rule. So it's very insidious. Socialism refuses to acknowledge the givens of human nature. If man is basically good, then he simply needs to be re-educated and corralled to understand what socialism is.
Social consideration programs and education and employment, and our own charitable giving and work is not enough.
And for them, how will everyone be equal? And right now, if that's allowed to continue, equality is the imagined goal, even though it won't be in the case, even in the new heavens and the new earth, according to 1 Corinthians 3, verses 12 through 15. Where some people's work will be burned up, others won't. Or their work will be burned up, but only that which is of value will remain.
So we know, and we see this really, I'm going to be skipping this part. We don't have that much time. But we know how this works. Socialism taxes producers, tries to tax producers very heavily. And this has deleterious effects. Producers actually start stashing assets instead of using them to develop business and hire people. Why bother? Most of the hard, time-consuming work will bear fruit not for them but for the state. And meanwhile, of course, non or minimal producers receive more without having to earn it. So they begin to wonder why it's necessary to work at all, since the state provides for their needs and more besides. And we're seeing that already in a massive scale in terms of living allowances, food allowances, car allowances, and car insurance allowance, at least by me, just about everything from top to bottom. And so both become enslaved. The producers, through a plethora of bureaucratic regulation and legalized theft, and the other through bribery to the point where personal freedom and dignity are abdicated. And as the social order unravels because of this, the socialist state looks to blame anyone but itself. It may even make some adjustments, but by now it's too late to turn things around without jettisoning socialism entirely. As we, by the way, have recently seen in Brazil, which is interesting to watch. And so socialism will resist this with all its might, as we're seeing in the U.S. And since that's the only way it can stay in power, that's what it's going to do. It's going to stay in power, quote-unquote, for the people that it has enslaved. The new socialism is Absalom, while the old order, with all its intended problems, is David. Absalom is young, popular, inexperienced, heady, ambitious, and unafraid to justify the wicked means for imagined ends. David is old and getting older, less popular, though he has his loyalists, rife with the lessons of history, and has come to understand that the ends never justify the means. Absalom is the anti-David, the grasping, self-proclaimed inheritor of the substance that David has gotten without looking for it, but by covenant, which Absalom knows nothing about. Everything Absalom enjoys is because of David, which plays no small part in his wanting to supplant him. The liberal elite, lobbyists, hedge fund managers, movers and shakers, pivoting between government and industry, are Achitophel. To them, Absalom looks like he's the future, and so they're hedging their bets to secure what they think may be their place at the table with him. Since Absalom has no track record, he has to corral as many as possible into his camp, even the doubters on the periphery. It's curious that socialism and its claim to stand for the oppressed has cobbled together as part of its coalition people that other socialist states would not only shun but would destroy. Abortion, homosexuality, fornication, and the like, known by socialists to be Christian taboos, are championed as rights, though historical constitutional civil rights have nothing to do with any of that. And in this way, socialists demonize Christians and the old order with which they're associated as repressive, and win people who are in a state of self-suppression, needing to justify their sin. So the polls are not with us, if polls can be believed. We have reason to believe that polls shouldn't be believed, but millennials and generations younger are leaning, if not entirely to the left, then toward outcome-based social policies. And these include evangelical Christians. Part of the reason for this is because of what happened in 2007, 2008, which created or increased the income or wealth gap, which is largely seen as unjust by younger generations. That traditionally happens after a depression or a recession, and it eventually corrects itself too, but people are taking the short view when it comes to things of that nature. Can't get through all this. I'm going to skip some of this. Moreover, not to be entirely negative, but moreover, millennials, the younger generations, after decades of revisionist education in public schools and universities, have shifted from an ideas have consequences perspective, which really is sort of covenantal in its way, to a policies have outcomes outlook, more pragmatic. Even if ideas have consequences, the process takes too long to germinate, whereas well-intentioned social engineered policies promise quicker and more humane results, and plus they make us feel better, even though long-term they deliver just the opposite. And the example of that, again, was the Clinton-era-initiated subprime mortgage fiasco. America has always been a pragmatic nation, though one also grounded in principle. But any grounding in principle, principial discipline from which to draw inferences for public policy and action is fast disappearing among younger generations. postmodernism, which undergirds much of university education today, has for decades taught that any worldview based on principial understanding, whether recognizably religious or not, is a mere construct created by past generations to ensure their own social control and power. And, you know, the idea that we, from Romans 13, which we know well, in terms of what the state's responsibility is and the social order to protect society from violence. So this, too, is beginning to pass. Then that, of course, is the legacy of the Protestant Reformation, the limits of government. But this is largely seen today as heartless, cruel, and out of touch. It's just not enough. The government for the people, among many today, no longer means government getting out of people's way for us to conduct our lives in liberty and peace, which the government ensures by enforcing just laws. Instead, it's coming to mean, what has the government done for me lately to make my life more comfortable than it already is? Free healthcare, government-sponsored education, track to success, guaranteed income, things of that nature. So the lure of socialism is to position government and its institutions as a replacement for the family and the church, as agents for life learning and support. It will take care of your needs, physical and psychological, which really means spiritual. You have more important things to worry about, and of course socialism's policies aim to weaken family and church in order to more easily usurp their legitimacy and authority. And they're counting on people giving up. Right. They're counting on people just saying, you know what, this is just so much easier. Why wrestle? Why struggle? Why try to move forward seemingly up a hill? And the discouragement is, as more and more people make that decision, then you're the only one that seems who's moving up that hill. Like, why am I doing this? So that's what they're kind of counting on. Um, I have to figure out what to skip because I can't get through all of this. Sorry. Thing is, we know this well, and this is partly what needs to happen. And there are people who are doing this, but it needs to happen on a broader scale. Free market capitalism presupposes liberty, and that's the kind that allows people to believe, worship, work, earn, take up different interests, speak and move about freely and lawfully without fear of unjust retribution from the state. But what does liberty presuppose? Isn't it the Christian faith, the belief and understanding that so long as a people abide by God's law, in however basic or detailed form, and hopefully from the inside out, that they are free to live without state coercion or restraint. That is what makes for a free people. So self-regulation makes tyrannical regulation unnecessary, and the reverse is also true. So where did this come from? It wasn't intellectually cobbled together by liberty-loving men. It wasn't only that. It really has a history that goes back many hundreds of years, based on Christian influence. And it presupposes a lot from the people, not over whom this government rules, but that this government is supposed to represent. It presupposes that these people it represents have the wherewithal to make judgments that are informed, wise, and morally sound, instead of ignorant, foolish, and immoral, in order to have a just and healthy society. And that's how our society is set up structurally. It will reflect the values of the people in this society. Now, we may say, well, we would prefer a different structure. Maybe so, but this is the structure that we have. And so education is critical, as is, I would say, an outreach, more concentrated and, lack of a better word, professional outreach from the Christian church.
Are you saying every society is like that, or America?
The United States, yeah. Because of plurius unum, because of political polytheism. So, you know, we have, when we first started, the assumption was that people could be free because the assumption was that everybody was a Christian or so identified with Christianity, but that structure is still in place, even though the cultural reality doesn't fit that structure anymore. So we haven't changed the structure to meet the new reality.
Well, we see a lot of people pushing for that now, right? Sort of in a more bold way than we've probably seen in a while.
For
in terms of people actually pushing socialism.
Oh yeah. Well, and the whole it's all of a piece. So the idea of liberty and it being based on Christianity carries with it a whole host of assumptions that expresses itself culturally and then as a result societally. And as that begins to fray and then disappear generationally or because of different people groups that are coming in that don't share that view, then all of a sudden we begin questioning very basic understanding of what our laws are, the constitutionality of things, the whole role of personal responsibility, etc. So it's a challenge to think about how to get that back. And I'm going to try to jump to that now. Thing is, we do have reason for for some encouragement. You know, I do think, for example, and we've seen this since the last congressional election, but things are already beginning to turn over. So when we look at these issues like Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, you know, not to pick on any one specific policy, but where we just roll out trillions of dollars and commit ourselves to spending trillions of dollars for social programs, that had gotten a lot of media play after Congress's election. But now we see that Joe Biden is running as the closest competitor to the president. So all of these other views are beginning to take a back seat once people begin to understand the cost involved in seeing these things through. So, you know, the notion here is that sin has sort of joined the panoply, the grand panoply of pluralism in American society. It seeks to legally subvert law to advance itself. And with God disregarded, so is law. Rushdoony wrote, this is over 40 years ago, quote, the humanist insists that the ordering comes from the mind of man, the belief that the mind and ideas of man are determinative of reality is basic to this modern worldview. While this idealism prevails, he said, a society will be essentially political and sociological, rather than theological and economic. So that's what you're seeing, like all of this flurry of how do I feel about it, what's going on, it's all sociological and psychological, but it's not really in terms of economic and, of course, ultimately theological. And yet there's hope here because people are beginning to wake up in terms of the actual cost involved in this and the routing, really, almost like a Bolshevik routing of established wealth in the country in order to see these dreams supposedly turn into reality. And we are seeing conflict and disorder in these pockets of atheistic humanitarianism, of this political and sociological crowd, not unlike the armies, I would say, of nations that besieged, outnumbered Israel in many instances in the Old Testament. So, we can say that it's always darkest before the dawn, and hopefully that's what we're looking at or will be seeing. I don't have time to describe them here. We can talk about them later if you're interested. But there are a lot of things that are going out there in terms of numerous outreaches that touch on the hot button issues of our time, Christian responses to on the ground responses to Black Lives Matter, to homosexuality and gay marriage, to evangelism among people who would never dream of darkening the door of a church. There are a lot of things, very unsuccessful things, that are going on, mainly in the inner cities, along these lines. These are deeply cast societal problems in a horizontally defined culture, most of which have been roundly politicized, as though only legislation can do anything about solving these problems. But legislation, we know, is not the answer until the blame falls not on other people or the system, but self-consciously on oneself. There could be no hope for change. And that's where these individual ministries, or let's say outreaches toward employment for the indigent, counseling in terms of homosexuality and gay marriage, abortion, some very really well developed and
highly honed crisis pregnancy operations in this country, that's where the change is going to occur on a relationship basis with people. So it's we're back to 1,000 points of light. That's what has to occur. And it's sort of frustrating because we think of ourselves as, well, we're only one point of light. What are we? But we're part of a constellation of what's going on from a kingdom perspective. You know, in the end, in man's quest for self-order without God, chaos inevitably ensues, while with God, scattering in judgment, he ensures order even out of chaos. And the pattern is there. Babel builders are allowed to build up to a certain point. The tower will be allowed to rise, but only so far before God comes down. The wine goblet to fill to its brim, even as we uncomfortably watch, before it's divinely dashed to the ground. And we don't know exactly what that will look like or when it'll happen, but we do know the eventual result and the antidote. A kind of Pentecost. The decentralization of man's order, chaos for man to once again order himself under God, and as such, under liberty via Reformation. So, coming soon, not too soon, or in North America, not at all? Time will tell. In the meantime, we need to look up vertically, even as we work with others horizontally, and remember, according to the Belgic Confession, Article 13, that, quote, nothing happens in this world without his appointment. He, not man, orders and executes his work in the most excellent and just manner, even when devils and wicked men act unjustly. End quote. So that's good to know, good to remember, and that's why we can sing Onward Christian Soldiers, whatever the weather outside. So I'll stop here. You know, there are other things I could say, but if you have questions, I'll try to address them. I know we don't have a lot of time. Yes?
You started the talking about that socialism is a religion.
Yes.
You also talked about, you know, the next generation of people who is evangelical Christian. So I think what we can see is that there's a large percentage of Christians that, A, don't even recognize that there is light or opposition.
Right. There's ignorance.
Even more so, more alarmingly, there's a growing percentage of Christians that are actually
identifying with
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, how would you go about, or how would you recommend addressing that?
Yeah, there's no silver bullet, but there are things that we can do. You know, one of the things is to bring into, perspective what we're also hearing in other places. One is the economic situation that we're in versus the economic situation we'd most likely be in if they had their way, which they would. These facts come in handy. So, this I got from The Economist. My son calls it The E-Communist. But it's actually, they do try to be objective on some of this. And the facts do speak for themselves. So, James Carville, who is Bill Clinton's political campaign manager, wrote an editorial not too long ago in the Wall Street Journal about how, is the economy stupid?
You know, you have to talk to people about money, because that's where most people are in terms of middle America, raising families, paying mortgages, paying that car payment, you know, et cetera. And the interesting thing is that none of them are talking about that. I mean, well, they're talking about giving stuff away, but they're really not talking about the economy itself. So he said, you know, you really want to appeal to bread and butter issues, but there's a reason that the president's opponents don't want to take up this topic. There's plenty of bread and it's heavily buttered. 90% of the firms in the S&P 500 index saw their sales grow. This is 2018 over 2017. 90% saw their sales grow compared to 69%, a 69% 10-year average, and a low of 36% in 2009. Profits grew by 25% over 2017. That was just a year ago. And this spurred firms to beef up capital spending, invest more in research and development. And this means, of course, even more employment atop the record-breaking employment figures achieved since Trump's election. There are polls that show that Latino voters would vote for the president. 60% of Latino voters would vote for the president. So there are positive things that are out there that we're not hearing about. I would say the other thing in private conversation and things of that nature is, well, first of all, I mean, I don't want to sound like a pious poop, but we need to take scripture for what it says. So, you know, 1 Timothy 2:2, pray for rulers and authority. Don't stop praying. Make that part of your regular devotion. The other thing to understand, I think, is that whereas the new socialism wants to separate liberty and personal responsibility, we know that they are inseparable. You can't separate liberty and personal, you can't. They're inseparable. If you want to be free, you have to be responsible. And we can make that clear in conversation without reference to political parties or personalities. We can talk about the actual, you know, and the whole thing of human dignity, all of those issues. And we have numbers to support that in terms of employment. We're at record employment at this point. The other thing I think too, likewise, is important is that corporate business, we shouldn't treat corporate business as inherently good or evil. Where it commits fraud, it must be held to account. And that's also true for government, regardless of how the government is structured. So, you know, there are ways to think about and talk about putting scripture above any institutions or any philosophical orientation that those institutions have. You're for corporate America. No, I'm for free enterprise capitalism. So where there's fraud and where there's, you know, obvious crimes involved, white collar crimes, you know, that needs to be addressed. You know, those are some of the things that we can do. In conversation, too, you know. My wife works at Hackensack Medical Center. She's the she's the only person in her entire department who voted for Trump in the last election. So you could talk to her about some of her strategies